Well, good evening, everybody, and thank you for the invitation to be able to speak to you tonight on this subject. This afternoon, we heard a very moving and tragic story, didn't we, of a Holocaust survivor, just a young man at the time when he experienced those things. And of course, there were children much younger than he was. He was 14, I think he said, as he first went into the camps. And of course, there were just little children that went into the camps as well. And for us, we're so spoiled, really, aren't we? And it's hard for us to imagine what it would be like to experience something like what they experienced, to have no memory of anything but walled-off ghettos and death camps, to not experience the most simple joys of life, to be liberated from the camps and to see a flower for the first time. That's what happened for the little children. That's what it was like for them. We have no concept of what that would be like. At the Holocaust Remembrance Day in Israel this year, so every year it's remembered, and it's already occurred this year, and the Chief of Staff for the Israeli Defence Forces, so this is the man who's in charge of the entire Israeli Armed Forces, he's in charge of the Air Force, Navy and Army. He gave a speech, and some of what he had to say went like this. We look to those who did everything possible to survive the horrors, those who overcame the hunger and the disease, passed the selections, escaped from gunfire and gas chambers. They survived to recount their stories so that the entire world will remember and not forget, to establish a national home for the Jewish people, to be a defensive shield and to confidently say, and remember that word, confidently, to confidently say, never again. On this day of self-examination, we once again renew our oath to those who experienced the horrors of the Holocaust and the promise that the Jewish people will never again stand defenceless. Well, tonight, that's kind of a summary of what I'd like to talk about. I want to talk about the Jewish people going from what we heard this afternoon of being from this position of helplessness, powerlessness, to coming to the point where they are today, where they can confidently say, never again. I want to tell you stories that show how God, in contrast to the speech that the Chief of the Israeli Defence Forces gave, where in that speech he did not mention God once, not even once. Almost a bit of a surprise for some of us what we heard this afternoon too about Peter, wasn't it? His comments about the use of the word miracle, and yet he claims he doesn't believe there is a God. And so the Israeli Defence Force, the Chief of Staff, did not mention the name God once, but I want to show you stories that show how God has helped Israel to survive, and more than just survive, to become strong. But first of all, why? Now, Brother Mark spoke to us a little bit about that this afternoon. But I want to show you someone who did understand the Jews' suffering. If you could turn with me to Daniel and chapter 9. Daniel chapter 9. Now Daniel, it's like Peter who we heard this afternoon, was a young man when he was taken away into captivity in Babylon. The Jews had been, or the kingdom of Judah in particular, had been destroyed by the Babylonians. Now the Babylonians took away anyone into captivity who they could use. As for many others, they perished or were simply just left behind as a remnant in the land. It's interesting to see what Daniel has to say about this. So in Daniel chapter 9, and we'll read from verse 5, Daniel says, "We have sinned and have committed iniquity and have done wickedly, and have rebelled even by departing from thy precepts and from your judgments. Neither have we listened to your servants the prophets, which spake in your name to our kings, our princes, and our fathers, and to all the people of the land. O Lord, righteousness belongs to you, but to us is confusion of faces, as at this day. To the men of Judah, and to the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and to all Israel that are near and that are far off, through all the countries whither you have driven them because of their trespass, that they have trespassed against you." And so what Daniel is saying is, we have sinned. Was he responsible in any way? He was just a young man, a godly man. But you see, he's speaking collectively. We like to speak as individuals, don't we? And the culture that we come from encourages that. It's typical for us to say, well, it wasn't my fault. It's their fault. But Daniel doesn't say that. We have sinned. He speaks of the whole tribe of Judah. And so here we have God's people attacked, slaughtered, enslaved, and taken away into captivity, into a foreign land. And what does Daniel say? Does he say, God, why have you done this? We are your people. How could this possibly happen to us? If we be God's people, supposedly, what kind of a God is this? There is no God. There is no God. And many of the Jews came to that conclusion because of the Holocaust. But Daniel doesn't say that. He says, I know why we have sinned. You see, it's not God's fault. Yes, God brought the Babylonians against them to take them in their captivity, but it was only because of their sins. So what about the Holocaust then? Well, this afternoon, our brother Mark referred to Jeremiah and chapter 16, where we read there of God sending fishers, people who would encourage the Jews to return to the land. Failing that, God would send hunters. And of course, Adolf Hitler falls and the Nazis fall into that category of hunters. And why did God do that? To make them return to the land. There was a reason for it. There were many Jews who were returning to the land, and yet there were many who had no intention of doing that. Their lives were comfortable. And yet the Germans changed all that for the Jews. They said, no, you're not one of us. Right when the Jews thought they were. We had Jewish men who had served in World War I and fought for the Germans, and they had medals, the highest distinction. They threw them in the camps too. So with that as a foundation, I want to talk now about how the Jews move from this period of weakness and persecution to strength and confidence. Remember, that was the word that the chief of the Israeli Defense Forces said, to confidently say, never again. Well, following World War II, the Jews, of course, are liberated from the death camps, the concentration camps, as Peter told us about this afternoon. Great Britain was still in control of Palestine, which was to become Israel. And the Jews are returning to the land. They've been returning to the land for decades. And by 1947, just 2 years after the end of World War II, there are 630,000 Jews living in the land of Palestine. Now, the British allowed the Jews to arm and protect themselves because they were coming under attack from the Palestinian Arabs. Some of the Jews had really good relations with the local people, but some didn't. For instance, the land that was being bought up by wealthy Jews so that Jews could then move in and farm it got the locals offside by saying that they couldn't buy the land. So if they wanted to put it up for sale, you could only sell the land to another Jew. You couldn't sell it to a Palestinian Arab. You imagine how that made the Palestinian Arabs feel when they found out about that. And so things began to get a little uneasy and they began to attack the Jews. And so the Jews were allowed by the British to form armed groups that looked something like this. You notice the three soldiers on the left are wearing Turkish uniforms, the next two are wearing British uniforms. There are four armoured cars there and every single one of them is different. There is no standardisation whatsoever. They were using anything they could get their hands on. But what the Jews really needed was real armoured cars, not things like this that you can see they've practically built them themselves, just from slabs of steel to offer some kind of protection. They needed real armoured cars. And the British in Jerusalem, for their own protection, had vast amounts of weapons inside guarded enclaves. Inside were also police and armoured cars as well. Well, the Jews were aware of this great treasure that lay behind the barbed wire, and they were determined to get their hands on it. So one dark night, an armoured car, armed with a machine gun and full of ammunition, headed off out of one of the largest of the enclaves of the British. The Jews then took over the vehicle, driving it to a Jewish settlement where it was hidden in a barn under a haystack. The very next day, another armoured car was stolen. One of those. And they hid it in Jerusalem. They just drove it straight out of the Allenby Barracks, and hit it in Jerusalem. How you hide a vehicle like that in a city, I really don't know. But the British looked everywhere and they couldn't find it. Well, they were a little bit upset about this, and so the British demanded the immediate return of the armoured cars from the Jewish authorities. But the Jewish authorities couldn't comply even if they'd wanted to. They simply didn't know where the cars were. There was only a very small number of Jews who were made aware of this plan. Within days, both of these armoured cars was used to defeat a large Arab force near to Jerusalem. You see, they got their hands on those vehicles just in the nick of time, and that's the way the story always goes with Israel. It's with similar cunning that the Jews managed to arm themselves progressively towards their independence. Well, it was in 1947 that the United Nations had their vote on whether the Jews would have their own, not just their own homeland, but have independence, an independent Jewish nation. The vote could have gone against Israel, but the Jews cunningly again went to work, contacting various people. They blackmailed people, and eventually they got enough countries to vote for them, and so the vote went in favour of the nation of Israel. And then in 1948, they finally gained their independence. On the very same day, seven Arab armies invaded. 23,000 soldiers. They could also call upon occasionally 50,000 Palestinian Arabs, but who were not organised at all. They're basically any Arab with a rifle at home. If he decides to go out and shoot at some Jews, then he would join in the fighting. If he didn't feel like it, he didn't bother. Okay? So about 50,000 of them they could sometimes rely upon. But 23,000 core army troops they sent in. They had tanks, they had fighter planes, and they had bombers. Against them, Israel managed to get together their various armed groups. Some of them were formed to protect the Jewish settlements. Some of them were basically terrorist organisations. They managed to get them all together, 35,000 strong, and they could call upon another 30,000 people, basically as a reserve force. They had no tanks, no fighter planes, no bombers. How could they ever hope to stop the Arab armies? Well, that's now what I want to tell you, the story of the farming community, or as the Jews call it, a kibbutz, of Yad Mordecai. That's what's left of it now. Now, the Egyptian invasion force. So this is the Egyptians. They're coming up from the south, and they came up the coastline of the Mediterranean, and the force split in half. Some went towards Jerusalem. The rest of them kept heading up the coast in the direction of Tel Aviv, which was a very important city to the Jews. 10,000 of them. And Yad Mordecai lay in their path. They had bypassed many settlements, but they thought this one was just a little bit too big to bypass. And so they decided they would attack this settlement. So with 2,000, remember, this is a farming community we're talking about. A farming community. A commune. They attacked it with 2,500 men, tanks, artillery, and air support. Defending the place, they set all the children away. They'd already left, and many of the women had also left. There was 130 defenders. 20 of them are women. They're mostly armed with rifles. They have one machine gun and one handheld anti-tank weapon. The odds are enormous. Remember those odds, 2,500 men with all that equipment behind them against 130 people who are not very well equipped at all. Many of these people in Yad Mordecai were Holocaust survivors. There's a photo of some of them there. Have a look at those faces. Would you want to take their land off them? I wouldn't. Very stern group of people. Some of these people who are Holocaust survivors have been through a terrible time. These are tough people, and they're not likely to give up their farming community too easily. Well, the Egyptians prepared themselves for 2 days for the attack. And when they finally attacked, they only managed to breach the perimeter fence, and then they were driven back. Dozens of them were killed. The kibbutz suffered 5 dead and 11 wounded. The very next day, they attacked time and time again, and they were defeated every single time. By the end of the second day, they had suffered a further 13 dead and 20 wounded. Remember, there's only 130 of them. The casualties are really mounting. However, they were reinforced that night. The Egyptians then resorted to levelling the kibbutz with artillery over a period of 2 days. So they've got our guns blasting away at them for a two-day period, and then finally, with dozens wounded, their defenders pleaded that they would have permission to retreat. And then on May the 24th, 1948, the final assault began. The Egyptians opened fire with their artillery for 4 hours straight, pounding the place. Immediately after that four-hour period ends, the infantry charge in. They'd already taken control of part of the kibbutz. Now they charge in and finally seize control of the whole of the kibbutz. At last, the Egyptians were victorious. Problem was, the Egyptians had expended a huge amount of ammunition in bombarding the kibbutz for 4 hours, which was a real shame for the Egyptians, because it was only once they had seized control of the kibbutz that they realised there was nobody there. They'd all left the night before. And so they've been firing for 4 hours at nobody. And so fine, I'll just show you that shot again. So there it is. You can see the damage that's been done to some of the buildings and so on there. And that was all they left of the place. And so finally, they had seized control of this little farming community of Yad Mordecai. Now, what had these defenders achieved? Well, in terms of casualties, the Egyptians had suffered 300 to 400 dead and wounded. That's one tough farming community, isn't it? The kibbutz had suffered 26 dead and 49 wounded. But even more important than that, the Egyptian army had been held up for 5 days. Remember, Israel has only just got their independence. They're not really fully prepared for war yet. Those 5 days were critical. In those 5 days, the Jewish army goes to work, the Israeli army goes to work, prepares defences to the south of Tel Aviv. By the time the Egyptians get there, the Israelis were ready for them, and the Egyptians were defeated. So at the start of this war, in 1948, that's what the map looked like. Now, the areas in orange are the areas controlled by the Israelis. It looks like a checkerboard, doesn't it? How on earth do you run a country that looks like that? And of course, the other areas are held by the Palestinian Arabs. By the end of the war in 1949, the map looked like this, and notice the difference. The Israelis have done all right, haven't they? Now have a look particularly in the middle of the map, and you can see the Israelis have pushed in right there. And right at the end of that, those sitting at the front can probably see it, is Jerusalem. You can see what they wanted. The Jews wanted Jerusalem. Let's have a closer look at the Jerusalem area. So the area in grey is the area held by the Israelis. And the important part is that brown area right there, the old city of Jerusalem. Bible prophecy tells us that in the last days, the Jews would be in control of Jerusalem. That had to happen. And yet they seized control of the old city at one point and were driven out again by the Jordanians. And so you can see the border finishes right there, just outside the walls of the old city of Jerusalem. They were so close, but God does things in his own time. Many people would have thought, well, this is it. The Jews had the old city of Jerusalem, just like the Bible says, and the war ended, and they'd been pushed back out again. Bible prophecy wasn't fulfilled, but it would be. God does things on his own time frame. The next war the Jews fought was in 1956. It's only 7 years later. Now, in between the wars, things had gotten really bad for the Jewish armed forces. Their equipment was in a terrible condition. Their tanks, for instance, if they went on some military manoeuvres, some training, and just 30% of their tanks reached the objective, they considered it a great success. That's how bad it was. It's a far cry from the modern Israeli army. Just so happened that France came to their rescue and sold them all the tanks and fighter planes they wanted, so that by 1956, they were once again ready for war. The Egyptians had been giving them a hard time, rattling the sabre, and the Jews decided it would be a good idea if they attacked the Egyptians first, which is what they did. And the story I want to tell you what happened there involves just 4 aircraft. That's a Mustang. It's a World War II aircraft. Remember, we're talking about 1956. World War II ended 11 years earlier, and the Jews are still flying these planes. Now, four of these aircraft were specially selected to take out the telephone wires that the Egyptians would be using. So when they come under attack, they would try to call back to Egypt and say, "We're under attack. We need reinforcements." The Jews didn't want them to do that. Hence, they wanted to take out the telephone wires. Now, remember, this is 1956, over 50 years ago. No satellites. Okay, you didn't just hop on the phone and a satellite sends a message across the world. No. Those telephone wires come down, there is no communication. How are they going to bring the wires down? Engineers designed a cable that would hang out the back of the aircraft. The aircraft would fly really low and the cable would cut straight through the telephone wires. The problem was, they can only do it once. The force of the impact would make the cable break off from the back of the aircraft. The engineers couldn't overcome the problem. And so that was just the way it was going to be. So there's four planes in two groups, two aircraft in each group. They can't communicate by radio in case the Egyptians are listening, so they only have hand signals. So the hand signals would be that you look across at the pilot in the next plane and you would either go thumbs up, which meant cable's still there, or the cable's gone. That was the only communication they really had. The whole four aircraft all took off before the Israeli army was to attack the Egyptians. They all took off, and before they reached their objective, the whole four planes had lost the cables. The whole lot. Now, you might be thinking, wait a minute, you said before this is stories about how God has helped them. How does this help them? If God was really helping Israel, every single one of those cables would have stayed in the back of those planes, wouldn't they? How does this help Israel? Just so happened there'd been an incident not too long before the start of this war. In this particular incident, there was an instructor up in an old bombing old trainer aircraft from one of the Israeli airfields. He was flying too low and he accidentally flew his plane through some power lines. He blacked out the nearby suburb for hours. When the plane landed, of course, the mechanics and someone all came out and inspected the aircraft and found no damage whatsoever. His propellers had cut straight through the power lines. Just so happened, not that long before these planes go on this mission. You know what the four pilots thought, don't you? They all thought the same thing. They thought, wait a minute, if a bombing old trainer can fly through power lines, our fighter planes could easily fly through some telephone wires. And that was exactly what they did. Instead of cutting one span and then losing the cable and then going home, they flew through span after span after span of telephone wires and they brought the whole lot down. You see, God doesn't always do things the way we expect. We would say, well, God would make sure the cables would stay on the back of the planes, but God had a better idea and it worked just brilliantly. Think of the odds of that happening. As a consequence, when the Jews finally attacked the Egyptians, they picked up the telephones to call Cairo back in Egypt. We're under attack. The lines were dead. Back in Egypt, they weren't aware that they'd been attacked for about 2 hours, which was critical time for the Israelis to make the most ground that they possibly could before the Egyptians would receive their reinforcements. By the conclusion of that war, the casualties were like this. The Egyptians had about 1,000 to 3,000 soldiers killed. The Israelis, 189. Wounded, 4,000 Egyptians. Only 899 Israelis. Captured. The Israelis captured 6,000 to 7,000 Egyptians. You know how many Israelis they captured? Just count my fingers. Four. Just four. Just amazing, isn't it? Incredible outcome for the Jews, who only a few years earlier were really worried about their armed forces because of the terrible condition that they were in. Well, that brings us to the 1967 Six-Day War. So it's now 11 years further on again. This is the most important war of all. The Jews launched a preemptive strike. So this time they started the fighting once again, a preemptive strike using 200 aircraft, and they flew beneath the radar. So they wouldn't be seen. Now you might be thinking, well, what could God possibly do? The Jews have everything under control. But God did do something. It just so happened on the day that the Israelis launched their attack, some of the top military commanders in Egypt were flying into the Sinai to inspect the Egyptian army. Now there were rebel elements in the Egyptian army. And the high command was worried that if they knew the commanders were coming, that they might try to shoot them down. What sort of an army is that? They actually thought that their own people would shoot down the commanders. And so they needed to come up with a solution. How do we keep our commanders alive? So you know what they did? They turned the radar off. So on the very day when 200 Israeli aircraft are on their way to attack the Egyptians decide to turn off the radar. So they had no hope of seeing them coming, even if one of the Israeli aircraft had accidentally popped up a little too high. So there's some of the Israelis in action. There's a bit of, some of the footage here is their training, and then later on it's some real footage taken from some of the aircraft during the actual attack. So 200 aircraft, as I said, involved. They destroyed 300 Egyptian aircraft on the ground. And this air attack is still taught to pilots when they're being trained for the Air Force to this very day. Now, nothing has ever been seen like it before. Then began the ground assault. One of the Israeli tanks advancing against the Egyptians, they're outnumbered 3-1. And yet, they managed to destroy 700 Egyptian tanks and only lose 60 of their own. Next, they turn on Syria. The going against the Syrians was tough. The Syrians had trenches and bunkers, and the Israelis were trying to force them out of these bit by bit, and the going was slow. But they were winning. It was just really slow going. And the Israelis were thinking, what do we do to speed things up? They didn't know what to do. So the Syrians did them a favour. Not that that was their intention. You see, the Syrians, because they were losing, wanted the help of the Soviet Union. But the Soviet Union didn't want to get involved because then America would help Israel and then you've got World War III. So the Soviet Union was a little bit hesitant about helping the Syrians too early. So what the Syrians did was they decided to trick the Soviet Union into making them get help them earlier. And so Damascus Radio, which is the capital of Syria, is Damascus. So it's basically their ABC radio. Damascus Radio announced that the Israelis had captured a particular town. Now this town, if the Israelis had really captured it, would have threatened Damascus. The plan was the Soviet Union would find out this news and think, we have to help our friends, the Syrians, now. And they would send forces straight away to help them. That was the plan. It backfired. They forgot one thing. The Syrian soldiers were listening to the radio too. So there they are in the trenches and the bunkers fighting the Israelis and giving them a really hard time, making a good fight of it. And then on their radios they hear, the Israelis have captured this town. And they thought, they're behind us. We're surrounded. So there's the Israelis trying to slowly drive them out of the trenches, and all of a sudden they saw the Syrians running for their lives. The Israelis were bewildered. What are they doing? They were putting up quite a good fight. They were giving us a hard time. They were slowing us down. And all of a sudden they run for their lives. So the whole plan just completely backfired on the Syrians. You see, when the Jews are cunning, it works. When their enemies are trying to be cunning, it backfires. Nothing seems to work for them. Isn't that strange? And we can see once again the hand of God at work. It reminds us somewhat, doesn't it, of David's prayer. May the counsel of Ahithophel be foolish or considered foolishness. And very often that's how God works. Rather than making us strong necessarily, Israel strong, he makes their enemies weak and foolish. Most important of all, though, is Jordan joins in the war. Now, why is that important? It's important because the country of Jordan controls the old city of Jerusalem. The country who controls the old city of Jerusalem, Israel must go to war with in order to take that off them. So it's very important that Jordan joined in the conflict. So there we see the front page of the Jerusalem Post at the time. The main heading is about the Israeli Air Force winning supremacy and driving the Egyptians back. And immediately under that, we see a secondary heading which says, Jordan shells Jerusalem, 10 dead, houses damaged. So there it is. Jordan opened fire on the Israelis. They also fired shells in the direction of Tel Aviv, and they launched an air attack on the Israeli Air Force at their airfields. Now Israel can counterattack, and of course they do. That photo there was taken very close to Jerusalem, just outside of Jerusalem. Old World War II tank that the Israelis have modified and Israeli infantry next to it. And they're slowly advancing, and what they're doing is bit by bit they are surrounding the city, the old city of Jerusalem, like a pincer movement coming around either sides of the city. What you're seeing there is a photo of a Bible prophecy in the process of being fulfilled. That's what it is. Aren't we blessed in the times that we live today to see something like this? And so finally they force their way into the city and they seize control of the old city of Jerusalem. And there we have a well-known photograph, three of the Israeli soldiers, in particular in the front, with the Wailing Wall behind them, a very important site for the Israelis, for the Jews. It's where they go to make their prayers at the Wailing Wall. We've probably seen them there, and they do the nodding thing as they say their prayer. That's it. That's at the Wailing Wall there. Now, the Jews hadn't been allowed to go near the Wailing Wall while the Jordanians had control of it. So from 1949 to 1967, no Jew had stood in that place. The first soldier, the first Israeli soldier to arrive at that site had been there. The last time he'd been there, he was just a little boy with his father. He's the first soldier to arrive there. Imagine how he would feel. What a privilege to be the first Jew in 18 years to stand there. And as he looks around, he sees freshly written on one of the stones on the wall in Hebrew the words, "If I forget thee, O Jerusalem." Who wrote that? It's quoting from Psalm 137 and verse 5. Psalm 137 was written during the Babylonian captivity. Like when Daniel was away, we read earlier, Daniel being in captivity. That was when that psalm was written. How appropriate that those words were written on that wall, but it is a mystery who wrote those words on the wall. And it's just amazing little stories like that just really I find quite incredible. And they come up time and time again in the story of Israel. After 1967, I'll just show you one more slide actually before we go on. A very important photo. I almost forgot to show you that one there, the Temple Mount. On the background there, we have the Dome of the Rock, which is the third most holy site to Muslims. And so there we have four Israeli soldiers, or five, standing there in front of that site, in control of the Temple Mount. Finally, we have a fulfillment of Bible prophecy with the Jews back in control of Jerusalem. Now, after 1967 war, some nuclear material goes missing in the United States of America. Just a little bit. About 200 tonnes of it. Oops, where'd that go? 200 tonnes just goes missing. It just so happens that shortly after this, Israel has a nuclear program. Suspicious. By 1972, they have nuclear warheads fitted onto missiles. Okay? So by the time the 1973 war comes around, they have a nuclear arsenal. Now remember where we're heading with this. Israel growing strong and confident. This is very key to this. And so then 1973, we come to the Yom Kippur War, a war which Israel almost lost. There's a gleeful Egyptian soldier standing on the east side of the Suez Canal. You can see behind there the Suez Canal and how they crossed over on a pontoon bridge. And he can't believe it. He's so pleased. He's still alive and he's standing on the east side. Total success. All the military experts and so on were really impressed with how the Egyptians managed to cross fairly safely over the Suez Canal. But Israel, as usual, slowly managed to turn the war around. And in this photo, we see the opposite happening. Now, it's Israel's turn that crossed the Suez Canal. So on the west side, there, the far bank of the Suez Canal, we see Egypt, or the continent of Africa. You wouldn't have believed it, would you? It's 1973 when this is happening. It's only 20 years earlier they're concerned about the condition of their armed forces. And there they are, crossing onto the continent of Africa. Really amazing what God has done for his people. Now, the Iraqis wanted to assist the Syrians up in the north against the Israelis. And so what they did was they sent their armoured force. They couldn't send them straight away. Otherwise, Israelis would know they were coming and they'd be suspicious. There must be a war about to start. So they couldn't send their army until after the Syrians had launched their attack on Israel. By the time they began to turn up near the battlefield, the Syrians were in retreat. Now, they had got across into Syria, where they were met, of course, at the border by the border guards and so on. The border guards said, "What are you doing?" And they said, "We're the Iraqis. We've come here to help you." And they said, "Oh, okay. Well, the battlefield's that way." And they said, "Well, have you got maps?" You see, the Syrians, because they were now losing the war, were so caught up in the turmoil of the conflict, had forgotten the Iraqis were coming. There were no maps for them. There was nothing. So they managed to get together some old maps that that car drivers would use, nothing better than that, and pointed them in the direction of the battle. Well, while the Israelis are pursuing the Syrians, they see the dust cloud. And the Israeli commander says, call the tanks back. And the Israeli tankers weren't too impressed by that. Here they are chasing the Syrians and thinking this is great, and they're called back. Why? You got to come back. So they're brought back and they're put up on all the hills around the road. So the Iraqis are coming down the road and all around the hills in ambush positions are the Israeli forces. And down come the forward elements of the Iraqi armoured division. And they come straight down the road, and to the amazement of the Israelis, they stop right in the middle of the valley. And they get out of their cars and their tanks, and they get their maps open. You don't see it much these days because of technology, but years ago, when people go on holiday, I used to see it. I'd go on holidays, and you see people with these big maps, and they put it on the bonnet of their car, and they all stand in it, and you see them looking at the map, and they're pointing the map. They're obviously lost. That's what the Iraqis were doing. They got their big maps open, they're all standing there looking at the maps and pointing down the road, and the Israelis were just amazed. And the order was given to fire. Well, of course, as you'd imagine, the Iraqi armoured force didn't last too long. Later that night, the Israelis bumped into the remainder of the Iraqi armoured division, and that was it. Iraq was out of the war. It was all over. It was the last Arab-Israeli war, the last major conflict. There's been nothing since 1973. There's been lots of clashes since then, but the Arabs haven't dared to take Israel on the way that they did in the past. If you could turn with me to Ezekiel in chapter 38. Ezekiel chapter 38, it's the chapter that was read for us. Do you remember the word that I asked you to remember? The Israeli Defence Force Chief of Staff said to be able to say with confidence, never again. With that in mind, we'll read Ezekiel chapter 38 and verse 11 and 12. So this chapter, of course, is about the great battle to come. It's something that's still future. The book of Revelation tells us the battle is the Battle of Armageddon. That name isn't used in Ezekiel 38, but it's the same battle. And so we have this army gathered together, massive army gathered together, a confederacy of nations who will come down against Israel. And we read in verse 11, and you shall say, I will go up to the land of unwalled villages. I will go to them that are at rest, that dwell safely. My margin says, confidently. That's what it says in the margin, confidently. Those that dwell safely or confident means this idea of being secure. All of them dwelling without walls and having neither bars nor gates to take a spoil and to take a prey, to turn thine hand upon the desolate places that are now inhabited and upon the people that are gathered out of the nations which have gotten cattle and goods that dwell in the midst of the land. Here we are being told that Israel will dwell safely. And for many years, Christadelphians have asked, how? They have rockets being fired at them and terrorist suicide bombers coming against them. This is going on all the time. State of war, constant state of war. How can they ever be dwelling safely? But you see, it's in the process of happening now. They feel confident. The Chief of Staff of the Israeli Defence Forces said so himself. To confidently say, never again. I want to talk about some of the nations who have been enemies and still are enemies of Israel, and to show you just how things have changed over the years. Let's start with Libya. They've been in the news of late, haven't they? So about 18 months ago, Libya still represented a potential threat to Israel. Now Colonel Gaddafi is gone. He's been overthrown. Libya no longer represents a threat to Israel. Egypt was Israel's number one enemy. They have now signed a peace agreement with Israel. We have an Islamic group who has now just won the elections in Egypt. Everyone was wondering what's going to happen. They have said, we will honour the peace agreement with Israel. There's still peace between Egypt and Israel. Saudi Arabia, many times had sent soldiers against Israel during the Arab-Israeli wars. Now they're more frightened of Iran because Iran is getting strong, they have a nuclear program, and they're a different branch of Islam. Okay, they are Shiites, the Saudis are Sunnis. They hate each other. And so Saudi Arabia is in talks very often with Israel, would you believe, as to how to deal with Iran. So Saudi Arabia doesn't represent a threat to Israel anymore either. Jordan, of all countries, they have wanted peace with Israel the longest. They finally got it. And they have economic agreements with Israel so they can both make money together. So they're good buddies as long as they're making money together. Iraq, remember Saddam Hussein? He launched about 39 Scud missiles against Israel in 1991. Saddam Hussein is gone. In his place now, there's still American forces, British forces in control of Iraq. Syria, they're in civil war now. They represented a threat only maybe just as little as 6 months ago. Now they represent no threat to Israel at all. Do you see what's happening? One by one, Israel's enemies are disappearing. Who does that leave us with? It leaves us with Iran over here with their nuclear program, Israel claiming that they will develop nuclear weapons. That's what their plan is. And the terrorist group Hezbollah over here in the south of Lebanon to the north of Israel, and down here in the Gaza Strip, which you can't even see on the map. Hamas is in control there, and they are hostile towards Israel as well. They're the only ones left who really pose any kind of a threat to Israel. What can Israel do about them? Well, the first thing they did was build that monstrosity of a wall. Just have a look at the scale of it. You see the people standing down there? That is one massive wall. They now can control the movement of people far more easily. I can't remember the last time there was a suicide bombing in Israel. The wall has worked. The people hate it, as you can see why. It just divides whole suburbs. But it has worked. They've stopped the suicide bombers. But what about the rockets? Israel's come up with a solution for that too. That's called Iron Dome. What you're looking at there is a box of missiles. And what they have is a radar system that detects a rocket being launched. Let's say Hamas launches a rocket from the Gaza Strip. The radar picks up that the rocket has been launched. In a split second, it calculates where that rocket is going to land. That's the technology we're talking about. It calculates in a split second. If it's going to land in a residential area, then they then launch one of these missiles or two of those missiles. They usually launch two at each incoming rocket and they shoot it down. If the rocket is going to land in an area outside of a residential area, the missiles don't launch. They just let it go. Incredible technology. They are still deploying this weapon system throughout the south of Israel. They've still got many of these systems to build, but bit by bit, they are giving security to the people at this point in time in the south of Israel and eventually over the entire country. That is the plan. The people who fire the rockets against Israel then end up being attacked and killed. Okay, the Israelis counterattack. Why would you do that? Why would you launch a rocket when you know that the rocket will be intercepted, you won't kill any Jews, and then they will retaliate and you'll end up dead? Why would you bother? And so eventually what we could see happen in coming months and years is these terrorist groups, Hamas and Hezbollah, come to the negotiating table with Israel to possibly end up making peace with Israel. You see, they are gaining bit by bit that security. What about Iran then? This is an American-made aircraft that the Americans supplied to Israel during the presidency of George W. Bush. Remember him? He supplied these aircraft to Israel. As you can see down the side of the aircraft here, there's something on the side of it. It's called a conformal fuel tank. It enables the plane to carry more fuel. They can fly from Israel and hit targets in the west of Iran. The Americans knew that, but they supplied the planes anyway. They've also supplied Israel with bombs that can penetrate deep into the ground before detonating. Once again, it's an American-made weapon. And the Americans and the Israelis know that the Iranians have put a lot of their nuclear facilities underground. The Americans have given Israel the tools they need to do the job. Then there's the submarines. German-made, paid for by the Americans. Israel had three of them. They've ordered another three. I think they've deployed maybe four now. So in total, though, they'll end up with six of these submarines. Two of the torpedo tubes are larger than a standard torpedo tube. And the Germans who built them, the government at the time, got into trouble. The opposition party said, why did you supply submarines with bigger torpedo tubes to Israel? Typical politicians, they said, oh, we don't know. They asked for it. We don't know what it's for. Well, of course they knew what it's for. The Israelis have cruise missiles that won't fit in a standard size torpedo tube. And so the larger torpedo tubes can fire these cruise missiles that can be nuclear armed. So we just go back to our map. What that means is Israel can now sail their submarines down the Red Sea, out into the Indian Ocean, and up into the Persian Gulf here, and launch their nuclear missiles, if they choose to have them nuclear armed, against targets right across central and eastern Iran. All of Iran is now within range of Israel. They have the tools to do the job. We could see, before Christ returns, or it could happen afterwards, we don't know, but we could see Iran knocked out as a threat to Israel. And so you can see that Israel is bit by bit gaining confidence, gaining security, and they are becoming arrogant. I want to tell you a few statements that they've made to demonstrate the arrogance and the confidence that these people have. Ariel Sharon, he was the Prime Minister of Israel, but when he was the Minister of Defence, this is what he said. He said, we can take the Middle East with us whenever we go. In other words, if our existence is threatened, if that's what it comes to, we will push the button. It's called the Samson option. What do you think it's called that? Remember what Samson did? There he is, caught by the Philistines. They're mocking him. They take him to the temple, and he leans on the pillars that supported the temple, and he said to God, let me die with the Philistines. In other words, my life's over, but let me take them with me. And God granted that. And he brought the whole temple down and thousands of Philistines died. And that's why Israel's nuclear program and their threat to use it is called the Samson option. Another Jew by the name of Martin van Krevold, a professor of military history at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, he said, most European cities are targets for our air force. We have the capability to take the world down with us. And I can assure you that that will happen before Israel goes under. Can you believe it? Making statements like that. And an Israeli official is recorded as having said, we can still remember. This brings us right back to the Holocaust we started with this afternoon. An Israeli official said, we can still remember the smell of Auschwitz and Treblinka. Next time, we'll take all of you with us. There's a threat, isn't it? What an incredible thing to say. There they were, defenceless, only 70 years ago. And today we see them with confidence, living in security, and being arrogant. Just as in the past, when Israel became prosperous and strong, they became arrogant, and they forgot God. And so too today. You heard what Peter said regarding his beliefs in God this afternoon. That view is shared by 30% of Israeli Jews. They don't believe there is a God. And yet tonight, the things that I have spoken about are some incredible stories. How can they deny it? They live there. How can they deny that there is a God, and yet 30% of them do. And so the scene is set, isn't it? Just as Ezekiel chapter 38 describes, all that is left is for the nations described in Ezekiel chapter 38 to invade Israel, for Jesus Christ to return, and finally for the Jewish people to acknowledge him as their Messiah.